Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings. Welcome to this episode of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I'll be airing part two of my talk with Steph Young on her book, Nightmares in the Woods. Coming up in the next few weeks, most likely, we're going to have Artie Six Killer Clark back. Jim Harrell will be coming on, I believe, in the beginning of October. And a few other people I'm still trying to shore up. One of the new things that is going to be happening, it looks like, is I am going to be having Steve Stockton do sort of a mini listener stories episode every so often. So you'll be getting more listener stories, and Steve's going to be spearheading that. And I think that's going to work out really, really nicely. So potentially you'll get three or four shows a week at some point here in the near future. Also, in part one of this series, I mentioned a website, a YouTube channel, actually, that had really covered the Lisa Lam thing very, very well. And I could not for the life of me find the link to the channel. But as a number of people helped me with as soon as it aired, the channel, I kept saying Green Dorks, but it's Geekin Dorks, GeekenDorx. And that is the name of the channel on YouTube. So it's youtube.com/user/geekandorks. And he has a lot of very interesting videos up there. The username is actually Lorden Arts. So you can find it any of those ways right there and check him out. Hopefully he'll be stopping on the show at some point. We'll talk about some of his work and some of his research into this stuff. So, yeah. All right. Again, I want to thank our patrons who have really helped us out, and I mean everyone listening helps, so thank you for listening. Thank you for everyone who has helped. It means the world to me. The feedback has always been great, and I'm glad you like the show. All right. Without any further ado, here's part two of my talk with Steph Young. Oh, and if you are a patron, you will get an extra bit from Steph this week. All right, and we are back with Steph Young for part two of this conversation on her book, Nightmares in the Woods. And how many books do you have out at this point?
I think it's probably six in this series, two on the drowning cases, and then the asylum and, you know, the kind of scary, ghosty type ones. So it's quite a few.
So you actually don't know how many books you've published at this point, do you?
No, because the thing is, I don't really see myself as like an author. I see myself as a researcher, and they end up going into books, if that makes sense. I think I'm more of a researcher than, I don't know. I don't know.
The books are just the collection of things that you've looked into.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, as we said, this one's Nightmares in the Woods, and this actually came out two books prior to where you are currently. After this, you released the Smiley Face Murders, right? Mm. Or Smiley Face Killers?
Mm. Yeah, because I'd done Dead in the Water, and it took in a lot of the theories and the possibilities, but I'd kind of left a lot out as well. Mm-hmm. So I did some more research, and I did some research actually into the UK cases, because the professor who was at first originally looking into them had said to me, you're following the Manchester ones, and this was about 2 years ago. And I said, well, I've had a look, but I'm not convinced necessarily. So actually I thought I'm going to do a really more of an in-depth investigation into it. Well, I'm still not necessarily convinced that there is a pusher per se, because there seems to be a couple of gangs that have gone to prison for pushing people in. It's very possible there's a serial killer that's done it, because the age range is very different to the one in the UK. However, if you take a radius of an hour to an hour and a half around Manchester, you'll get other university towns, because bearing in mind we're much smaller here than you are over there. Right. So whereas it might happen in New York, Boston and Wisconsin, for us that could be Manchester, Birmingham, Bath, all within sort of an hour and a half, not right. State to state. And the funny thing was that I found, in fact, there was a very, very definite pattern. I only looked at probably about 30 cases, but it took me a very, very short time to pull up cases that fit that college profile. So young man at college goes missing after a night out. That profile came up very, very quickly, and they all look actually quite similar, a lot of them. So again, I don't know at this stage, until I go even further into it, whether there is a serial killer operating and they're doing that particular boy because of their proclivity, or whether this is related to the American ones. So it's an ongoing thing at the moment. You can't do it that quickly, because you have to look at each case. And, you know, I've been like plotting on the maps where they went in and where they ended up, and why weren't they seen on CCTV? There's a lot of cases where they weren't picked up on CCTV. So they were seen leaving a club, then they were seen progressing. Some of them ended up back in the city in the water, but they're not captured on CCTV. So I think they're being put in a car.
We will discuss that one on a future show. And you also had, what's your latest one that you've put out?
Panic in the Woods.
Okay, and we'll get to that too. That's actually, now, did you intentionally name that from the whole pan thing?
Well, actually, I think when I spoke to you the last show, and you were talking to me about it, weren't you? And I said to you then, oh, I'm going to call it Panic in the Woods. And you said, that would be really like, the person that you interviewed,
Patrick Harper.
Yes. So I thought at the time, oh, I can't do that, because that's going to sound like, you know, like he's written about that. And then so I left it a while, and then I thought, but I really want to put that in as a title. So, I mean, in fact, it doesn't particularly cover Pan. In fact, I've written about Pan in this book, and, you know, goat sightings. It's like goat man sightings.
Right,
but
right.
No, Panic more in that one. Actually, there's a couple of really creepy human cases. There's an incredible story that was in the newspapers back in the 80s, where two boys are literally chased from state to state by what they say is a convoy of people. They try and get the police to help them. The police just say, you're crazy. They end up getting chased through the swamps, trying to swim in rivers, seeing some kind of sacrificial ceremony. One has a nervous breakdown. One ends up getting taken to court for breaking into a policeman's house because he was just trying to find some safety. And he didn't have his contact lenses in. And he picked up a knife to defend himself, and it happened to be a policeman. It just goes on and on and on. And you think, there's no way that happened, but they never changed their story. They were just college boys. They weren't on drugs. They were drug tested. They weren't drunk. They abandoned their car in an absolute panic. And it sounds like something from the scene in a movie like Deliverance, you know? It was that bad. Mm.
Well, we'll bring you back to talk about that book in the near future as well. And by then you'll have another book out.
I'm always working on them. I never take a break.
Patrick Harper, actually, he is mentioned in an article called Panic in the Woods.
Mm.
And his article that he wrote for some Fortiana magazine, I forget which one, is called Landscape of Panic.
Right.
But the panic thing also relates to Pan, and it's that sudden fight or flight thing that people sometimes experience when they're in the woods.
Mm.
Hence the panic thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you had him on, didn't you?
Yes.
A while ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
he's quite legendary, isn't he?
Yes and no. Mm. It seems like a lot of people nowadays don't know much about him.
But he was a very big figure.
Yes, he was a very influential figure.
Right.
And I was thrilled to get him on. And he's supposed to be doing a roundtable with us. And trying to organize that has been not fun because everyone's on different schedules.
Oh, no.
And, of course,
he's
over in the UK. And, right.
Right.
Actually, we're working on a few different roundtables, bringing some extra guests in. And every one of them is conflicting as far as schedules go. So eventually things will work out. These things happen. They'll work out when they're supposed to work out.
Yes.
And one of the things you cover in this book goes back into history. You talk about the Count of Saint Germain and some of the weirdness that surrounds him.
Well, I suppose I started writing about him because, of course, there's been accounts of him appearing at Mount Shasta, which is a very strange area, isn't it? And I was looking more into him, and I came across a translation of a letter that was sent from Voltaire, the philosopher, the French philosopher. And this was back in the 1600s, and he had written a reply to the Count of Saint Germain, and he'd said that you reveal frightening secrets, among which is the hour of my death, and your long journey through time will be illuminated by the friendship I have for you until the day your revelations come true in the mid of the 20th century. And he said the images that speak, which is also translated as the talking pictures, are a gift to the time that I have left to live. Your flying machines could one day bring you back to me. So what did he mean by talking pictures? Well, to me, that sounds like the black and white films when they first started coming out in their sort of 30s and 40s. The flying machines, well, Leonardo da Vinci, of course, had drawn up plans probably, I think it was a century before this, before their conversation, well, in 1400s. But of course, they didn't have any flying machines that actually worked. So I thought, well, this is really weird. You know, so he seems to be saying to the philosopher Voltaire, well, I'm predicting when you're going to die. And he was able to sort of say when this was going to be. But they would be reunited as though not particularly flying, because, of course, Voltaire would be dead by that time. So if you believe in life after death, he would be in another realm and the Count would be reunited with him. So I was thinking, well, is he talking about flying machines like airplanes, or is he talking about dimensions and time travel? Is that what he's talking about? Voltaire did write sci-fi in his day as well, and he sort of speculated, so perhaps you can say it was just a literary device. But also the Count had a very mysterious life, because there were so many accounts that people put in their diaries or in historical documents that said he never aged, and people like Casanova would write about him. And Voltaire wrote to kings as well, and said that, you know, he was a master of knowledge. And I also thought, well, illuminated, of course, can mean esoteric illumination, or it can mean the Illuminati. Well, the Count of Saint Germain was behind, supposedly behind a lot of, he was like a Greece emissary, Greece, I can't say it now. You know, those, it means that you're a very influential figure behind the scenes. So you might have an advisor, but they're not officially paid as an advisor. But they, you know, they'll go on an errand for you and they'll influence another country's politician and things like that. So he was believed to do that. But he was also, the Count of Germain was also part of the Freemasons, although they sort of wiped him out of their history. But he was taught in the ancient mystery schools. So he was in the Orient and then he came over to Europe, and he was given laboratories to work in, to do his alchemy in. So he would do that, but then he would go to dinner parties and meet sort of the kings and all the politicians. And of course, as time went on, he never looked any different. And he was never known to eat anything. So he went to dinner parties, but he refused to eat. If he ever did eat, it was something that had been prepared, and he would normally go to his own chamber to eat. And the only people who ever saw it said it looked a bit like kind of oatmeal, but they never saw him actually eat it. So, of course, my mind's thinking, well, was he like an alien, or was he immortal?
Robot.
Well, yeah, what was he? Well, the funny thing was, he could write with two hands at the same time in different languages. He could understand Sanskrit. He used to say he was at the crucifixion of Jesus, that he was there when the pyramids were built. If you were thinking of something, he would give you the answer before you'd even said the question. This was what was written about him all the time. So, you know, really, I was looking into him just thinking, well, when he was writing that letter, did he know more about being able to travel interdimensionally, or did he predict the future, or really what was he? Because then, of course, people used to say that they saw him at Mount Shasta. The funny thing is that the sightings of him have been with him talking with a British accent. Now, I don't know why, but the Lemurians are supposed to talk with a British accent, which is strange, you know. But that really, I suppose I was just going on an investigation of him to sort of see. I mean, he seems a very mysterious figure. And of course, he's either portrayed as a grand charlatan, or he was, in fact, illuminated and was able to perform, you know, feats where he could turn the tiniest pearls into diamonds and things like that. You know, so in fact, I was listening to music that he composed. So today I found some videos on YouTube. He's composed symphonies. So he wasn't trained as an artist, but he also did he made a text that couldn't really be deciphered, because Madame Blavatsky and Mally P. Hall, they wrote about some kind of messages being left in this text that he'd written, but it seemed to be sort of Kabbalistic and all sorts of different traditions, but nobody could really decipher what. So I mean, he's an interesting character. I don't know if it was all, you know, genuinely
propaganda,
true.
Right.
Yeah, I just don't know. Or whether he was more of a political mover. I don't know. But
it's definitely some weird stories. He could have just been very eccentric too.
Yeah, he could have been. And it could be a case where people say one thing and it gets changed with the next person, and you know, like it does these days, it could have all been exaggeration. But his letter's a bit weird. The letter is what I don't understand, because they didn't have flying machines. And if the philosopher Voltaire was going to be dead by that stage, how were they going to reunite? Because he used to say to people, I'm going to Shangri-La, I'm going to the Himalayas, but I'll be back in 80 years. So how were they going to reunite if Voltaire was dead? They wouldn't reunite with an airplane. So, and he didn't eat anything. So I'm thinking, well, where did he come from, you know?
Maybe they believed in reincarnation too.
But that, yeah, actually, you're right. It could have just been that, couldn't it? Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely some weird stuff with him. I mean, so far in the past, you know, record keeping wasn't like it is now.
That's true. Not as many people could read or write. No, that's true.
So.
Yep.
I don't know. It's sometimes when you look at these things so far back, it's like, that's really interesting, I think. You know,
yes,
it is. It's interesting because we don't know.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess it's mysterious because we can't unravel it either.
And because some of these concepts like flying machines, I mean, obviously the ideas were out there. Da Vinci put them out there. How many people knew about them is another question.
Yeah. Be good to know about him.
All right. Let's talk about Crater Lake, because this is a weird spot.
Yeah, it's supposed to have that really kind of strange, weird, negative sort of energy there. And I came across this story. A couple had gone there.
And before you get into that, where is Crater Lake for people who don't know?
So Crater Lake is in Oregon, and this was a story that went back to the 70s. And a husband and wife had gone there, and they were just enjoying the view. So it's a volcanic sort of lake. And they were just sitting there having a nice time, when suddenly the husband hands his wallet and his watch to his wife and begins to hurtle down the caldera to get into the water to try and kill himself. Well, in the process of going down, he broke his leg. But it didn't deter him. He crawled to the waterside and he got in the water and he drowned himself. You know, which is very strange. And actually,
was he suicidal before this?
Well, I don't know, because I can't find records. I can't get his medical records, so I don't know if he was. There didn't, in the archives that I found, there wasn't any indication that he was depressed. His wife didn't say that she knew that there was anything wrong with him. Perhaps he had financial difficulties, you know, and it was that. It's very hard to know. But actually, there was a more recent case where a man was very close to the lake there, and a ranger had seen him and just stopped him ordinarily and said, you know, hi, how are you? What's your name? Well, the man just took off he took off running, and he said, the ranger said, the last thing I saw was he just literally scaled down this sheer edge that would have been impossible to survive. But the even weirder thing was that he had a leg brace on at the time, so he couldn't really have run, but he managed to run and ignored the fact that his leg didn't work. So it was almost like he took off in this really strange panic, and they started to look for him because they were quite worried, obviously, for his health. But they never found him. And in fact, all they found was... they didn't even find his equipment. Everything was gone. So, I mean, you said to me, didn't you, about the possibility of there being something to do with the water. And water can hold negative energy when if you buy into the idea that, you know, these experiments that have been done that are quite famous, you know, where a scientist has said that if you talk nastily to one glass of water. So, I mean, it seems to be that you can imbue it with a negative sort of emotion and it will stay there. Other people say that that's hokum and that that's not true. But I was saying to you off air, Soraya, about somebody that I spoke to in Pueblo, Colorado, who had a experience where they had electrocuted themselves but managed to survive. And had been plagued ever since with seeing spirits and didn't want this, and didn't like it, but was lumbered with it, really. Well, he used to work many years after his first trade, which was electrical. He moved to being a kind of grounds maintenance person for a park and a lake in the area. And he was telling me on the phone that when they walk down to the lake and they're perfectly fine and look really happy, and then all of a sudden they get into this horrific row and one of them tries to drown themselves. And he said, this isn't just one case that I've seen. He said, I've seen this time and time again. I've seen single people go there and they suddenly hurtle towards the water and they want to kill themselves and sometimes succeed. But he said, but I've seen the spirits there. I can see these are dark shadows and I can see the form of them because of the fact that he sees them in his house. He sees them everywhere. He can see them standing at the water's edge, and they encourage people to do it. So they give you that doom laden feeling, and they then, you know, try and get you to go into the water. Again, it's not something that we can see. If we're not sensitive to that, we're not going to pick up on that. Right. But it's interesting that he told me that account, because he contacted me again, really, through another person I'd been speaking to. And actually, it was more to do with the cases of the drowning boys. But he's not the first one to contact me to say that. Actually, another person had already said that about Wisconsin and being able to sense these tall, dark, shadow-like entities, and believed that they were having an influence that I wasn't, you know, looking into, because I can't see them, I can't sense them.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I mean, my thing with water is that, so not only do you see, you know, missing people cases happen around water very often, which could also just be because they're drowning. But you see a lot of strange stuff happen around water. You see, for instance, UFOs are very common coming out of the water. And a lot of people don't realize that. They're usually called, USOs.
Oh, yeah.
Unidentified submergible objects. But there's a strong connection between UFO sites, lights and stuff, and water. Even who wrote Kon-Tiki, who did the travel, what's his name? Heidenal. I'm saying it wrong. But anyway, when they did their trip across the Pacific on their small little craft, at some points a UFO-like thing appeared underneath with swirling lights. And I say UFO not necessarily because it was a spaceship, but it was unidentified and it was under the water and it was just, they had no idea what it was, but it was underneath them, and they watched this thing just kind of glowing come up and sit there for a while before descending again.
My goodness.
So I feel like there's something with water. I mean, you get all the legends, too, of spirits and stuff. Like spirits, you'll hear tales of ghosts moving along underwater streams, or how spirits can't cross rivers and things like that. And I wonder if there's an electrical component to all this that affects whatever these phenomena are created by or affected by or something. It's just there seems to be a direct connection between a lot of this phenomena and bodies of water or moving water.
Yeah, I think you could be right, Soraya. There's not enough investigation into it. Yeah.
And we don't know enough either. I mean, this is the other thing. I mean, when you look at where people go missing and like fairy legends and stuff like that, a lot of those are connected to different types of rock. You know, granite in particular. Hauntings. If, you know, granite is the type of, is granite? I think granite.
Yeah, it's granite. Yeah.
They'll say, well, the place is on granite, so that's why it stores energy and so on and so forth. So I think we're missing something about our environment, and I'm not sure how it interacts with us, but I think there is something there that if we were able to understand, we'd have another piece of this puzzle, like overall.
The problem is being able to measure it, because I've read a lot of reports, because I've really tried to like come up with a scientific report that shows us that granite can cause a disappearance, for example. I can't find it, so
no.
I'm not, because I found reports that dispute it. So in other words, the amount of electromagnetism, for example, is not of a strong enough quality to seriously affect our brain or in terms of dematerializing us or something. So it's not that, I'm not saying that it's not possible. I can't find a scientific report to back up what I would like to be able to prove, because it's not there, I don't think, that I can find.
It may also be that just generally there may not be an effect, but maybe there's something cosmic, whether it be solar activity or gamma rays or something that are hitting us at the right time that set this stuff off.
Yeah, and it's exactly, I'm not saying that it's not provable, but it's almost like we don't know how we would measure it
in a scientific way.
How do we do it if we were a scientist? And of course that's the problem, isn't it? Because we can't get that proof. And but I think you're right. There's something there that isn't measurable in the most traditional of ways, but it's there and it hasn't been investigated
because
by those who could do it.
Almost every aspect of the paranormal seems to have environmental factors in it. I mean,
well, even if you just think about how it gets freezing cold. I was talking to a lady called Irene who runs UK Paranormal, and she's been sensitive to and battling with any form of entity, because I was saying how romantic it was to think of, you know, fairyland, and she said, believe me, there's nothing romantic about it. So she literally, you know, comes across all of these kinds of things. But when I was talking to her, gotten my point now. So she was telling me about when something had woken her up the night before, which happens all the time to her, and she said, but I knew it was in the room before it even came in because it was freezing cold. I mean, it's a hot summer here. So what's fascinating is even just that alone, you know, how it gets freezing cold when something happens like that, and yet we can't sort of measure it in a scientific way to prove that that's what's happening, but you can feel it.
And you can measure the temperature drop.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, you can prove the temperature drop. Yeah, but we can't say it's because that thing's there, because only the lady herself could see it, and I couldn't see it. You know.
Yeah, it's the stuff is just mind-boggling, really. And I think so much. I think environment is part of it, and I think consciousness is part of it, and I think that our concept of reality is wrong. And that's going to be the big thing, is trying to figure out how that is wrong that makes all this stuff work. I think we're a lot more interactive in our physical reality with consciousness than anyone realizes at this point.
And I also think that the reason there were so many stories about fairies in the 1700s or 1800s was because they didn't have TV or the internet or mobile phones or newspapers, so they were so attuned to nature. And you know, if you don't live in the middle of the countryside and live a really, really quiet life, you've got so many other distractions on that these things can be happening all around you, but you won't realize. So you have to kind of, without knowing it, you've probably switched it all off. You know, the sensors for noticing all of this are switched off.
Yep. And You also find like the Earthlight stuff, following fault lines and stuff like that, which again is another environmental factor. You know, UFOs seem to follow fault lines.
Well, it's like ley lines, isn't it? Because, you know, well, if somebody...
It's different than ley lines, but yeah, I mean, you get that too, where it seems like where ley lines are supposed to be, there's more paranormal activity.
Yeah.
And I do think some of the ley lines also follow fault lines.
Oh, do they? Okay.
I'm not 100% sure of that, but I'm pretty sure a few of them at least do, and especially in the UK.
Oh, okay.
But I know Paul Devereaux, when he did his, I think it's his Earthlights book, he showed that, you know, he could overlay UFO sightings with fault lines to like a 90% ratio.
Really? Gosh.
But the thing is, so if someone has a weird encounter with something and they've never encountered anything previously in their life, from that point on, very often they continue to have experiences. So it's almost like maybe the environmental factor combined with other things opens someone to this stuff. And once that door's opened, it doesn't close again.
Well, it was funny because I was also talking to a psychic medium at the same time I was talking to this other lady that I just mentioned. And he was saying how, you know, they can do readings of people. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I've had psychic readings in the past, but actually a lot of times it's been that they can't really get anything. And I said, is it possible that you can put a barrier up? And he said, well, yeah, of course you can, consciously. So you can put barriers up. So that would also mean that you're not allowing whatever it is that might be there to make its presence felt. I mean, I put barriers up on purpose, but you could also have them because you don't believe in it or you don't particularly have an interest in it. So why would you open yourself up to it? So I think as well, yeah, we can be quite closed to these things. And then, yeah, he said to me, if you wanted them to happen willingly, you would open yourself up to it, and it'd be a heck of a lot more likely that you would be attuned to it. So,
yeah, yeah. Well, some people open themselves up to it and get nothing. I think some of it too is like, you know, mm-hmm. some people are colorblind. You know, our senses all pick up different things, so some people may just not physically be able to, or their senses may not be able to pick this stuff up, no matter how open they are to it.
Yeah, you're right, actually. I had a conversation with somebody a while ago, and they told me how they had gone out onto a hill in England because they were really, really wanted to be abducted by aliens. And I said, why would you do that? Why would you do that? And he said, it's really exciting. I just want to do that. And I was thinking, oh, my God. But he, nope, didn't happen. Next night, no, didn't happen. Next night, I'm still here.
I think, too, there's a thing that when you're seeking this stuff out, that's when it doesn't come to you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's possible. They're probably hives.
it's the whole lust for result thing.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Let's get into Let's do the Pied Piper, because this is another historical figure that has some weird connections to missing people, and I don't know that people are really familiar with this legend, like they think they are.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, I knew it as a child, and I'm pretty sure it's kind of like a fairy tale that would have been a lot more prevalent, you know, a long time ago. But I'm sure everybody kind of knows of the story of the Pied Piper strolling into town in this little German village and playing his pipe, and all of the rats who have infested the town just follow him aimlessly and walk behind him, and he takes them to a river and they throw themselves into the river and kill themselves. Well, it was based on a poem, how we probably came to know about it, by an English poet called Robert Browning. So he made the poem well known. But what I didn't know was that it's actually based on a true incident. And it was in the Brunswick town in a very rural part of Germany. He wrote about it in the 1800s, but it had happened in the year 1200. So there's actually records of it in that town, and the church had a record of it in one of its windows, of the fact that actually it wasn't just the rats that went missing, it was the children of the village as well. So that church was destroyed in a fire in the 1600s, but there are written accounts that describe these children, and the children in the village simply vanished. So the poem says, of course, that at first this trickster looking figure turns up. So he's dressed in really bright garb, bright outfit, and he says, okay, I'll get rid of the rats for you, but you've got to pay me this money. So he does that, but when it comes to getting his money, the mayor of the town says, no, you're asking too much, I'm not going to pay you. So the trickster says, okay, well then I will take your children. So he leads all the children out with his pipe and they disappear into the side of a mountain. Well, so that's the story, but in the historical accounts, actually, there's only a couple of mentions of the rats, but there are mentions of the disappearance of the children. The way that the figure of the piper is described is that he's described like he's a walking cadaver. So it's like he's just got this big grin on his face, but he's a walking dead figure. So he sounds like a trickster, really, but the accounts of the children missing are in many, many historical documents. And some people have tried to work out, obviously, what really happened to the children, because mm-hmm. the poet says, well, they just went into the mountain and a portal opened and the mountain shut and they were gone. Well, some historians have said, actually, they were probably taken to be child soldiers, which is possible, but the actual fighting in Europe at the time, it wasn't happening in that particular period that they missed, that they disappeared. And the other opportunities for them to disappear are things like they were emigrated. So in those times, other countries would send out people called trepanners, who would literally say, right, you're coming with us, we're taking you, and we're going to set you up in our country because we need more people living here. But to those two possibilities, I suppose you would say, well, then why, surely they would take their parents with them as well, because the children were children, so they couldn't breed at that age. So they were looking for more people. Why didn't they take them? And if they were child soldiers, there wasn't any fighting going on at that time. So the mystery, I suppose, is that they genuinely disappeared. So in some manuscripts, it says that it was the devil himself that turned up and lured away the children and took them straight to hell. Most accounts of the old times probably lean on that possibility. One other theory is, of course, that they were victim to the plague, but the plague again hadn't taken effect at that time, and also it would have wiped out the whole village. So the point is that they definitely disappeared. Some people have said, well, you can trace some of their names to other countries, but again, that's quite a common thing, that you would find similar surnames. So that doesn't also necessarily pan out. So I suppose the question is, the Pied Piper was talking about being able to transport himself to Baghdad within an hour or so. So was he, again, some kind of strange interdimensional being that managed to vanish these children into thin air and take them somewhere else into a dimension? But if he wasn't, what happened to the children? Because they did disappear.
And I'm pretty sure most people have no idea of that full story.
I didn't know it was
I didn't. Oh, I knew it was a true story. I don't think I knew all the details.
Yeah. So the details about the rats, I don't think there actually was a rat infestation.
Yeah.
At all.
Or was it changed from, you know, pagan or something like that, as we've seen in the past? Chasing the snakes out of Ireland when really it was pagans.
I don't know.
You know, did rat, you know, start out as something else and just turn into something else in the you know, interim?
Oh, I see. Well, perhaps, but what? Yeah, but that would have turned the rats into children. I don't know. I don't know.
Again,
I just think. Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I just think it's fascinating to look back in time and to find these perplexing situations. And it's true, again, that not everybody in that village could have written, so they couldn't read or write. So, you know, ministers could write or town officials could write. So I suppose you say, well, perhaps if you'd have had all the accounts, you'd have found out what really happened. But of course, we don't have all the accounts. We only have the historical documents that some people wrote.
Yeah.
But a lot of people afterwards wrote about it. So I don't know if they were wrong or if they spun it the way they wanted to. Obviously, the ones that said it was the devil were probably the ministers who wanted to put that slant onto it for some reason, you know. But I don't know.
Well, it's a fascinating story regardless. So the last one I definitely wanted to talk about in this book was the Riddle of the Body Parts. So this is a chapter in here near the end.
Well, I saw a story that was described as something that wouldn't be out of place in a John le Carré novel. And John le Carré, of course, wrote spy novels. Because a body was found on a tree plantation on moorland near an isolated reservoir close to Todmorden. So West Yorkshire, which is up in the north of England. So it's quite rugged, quite rural. And this was back in 2007. And the detective inspector said that he was confident he'd solved 60% of the puzzle and kind of left it at that. So the focus really at the beginning was on trying to work out who he was. And his own life story was quite interesting because he seemed to have been born in Russia when they finally identified him after going through Interpol. And he was a 57-year-old man called Waldemar Shigalo. He's so bad at pronunciation. But he had left his home country and gone to Germany. And then he worked as a crime scene photographer. But while he was in Germany, his brother was mysteriously murdered by having his dinner poisoned. I don't know why that was. Then he'd gone to Canada, but his application was turned down. And then he ended up in London. But the time between London and when his body was found, which was about a year, they don't really know where he was. So he was found near this reservoir. And the inspector said, well, he was found in a really isolated spot. And it is possible that he died from hypothermia. But he said it has to be a very unusual case, to say the least, because, to be honest, I thought he'd fallen from an airplane. And the thing is, you occasionally do have tragic stories where somebody has tried to emigrate clinging onto an airplane, but I mean it's very, very unusual, and I haven't heard it really happen here in England. So I suppose the question is then, why did the inspector say that? Why did he seem to have injuries so severe that would make it look like he'd fallen from the sky? And the reason as well why it struck me was, of course, because I'm not sure, I think I might have mentioned it before in this, with you, Soraya, but it's in an area where a man had been found back in 1980 on a coal pile.
Yes. Yeah.
And so he'd had that strange experience, as well as the policeman and missing cows. But just a couple of years after this Russian man was found, there was again another body found in the same area. The actual search and rescue man, Mr. Day, who had gone looking for the body of the Russian man to recover it, had said, you know, no idea how we could have got here because it just didn't seem possible. So I suppose that one drew my attention because it is an area that it was having a lot of UFO sightings over sort of 30-year period. But what happened to the Russian man, I don't know.
And that you move on in that chapter as well.
Well, I found some old cases as well, because there was a man who was found in the 1800s in Plymouth, which is down in the southern coast. And the coroner had really just said found dead, because but he had no idea how. But his whole lower portion of his body was mangled and mutilated. Well, in those days, of course, we didn't have cars. We did have, I suppose, rudimentary farming equipment, so perhaps you could say, well, that's what happened to him. But the rest of his body wasn't touched, so I don't know. Sometimes if you look through really old coroner's reports, you find some really baffling cases. And again, you could say, well, it's because there's not that much information, but actually some of these accounts are very thorough. They, you know, you can get hold of all of the really thorough, complete reports on them. So some of them are very baffling. And I also found a place that seemed to have speaking of caves again, that seemed to have a really mysterious cave, because a mining society had actually looked into this, because in the 60s, human bones had been found in it, but piles of them, and they had really large hands.
Which is weird.
Which is really weird, because nobody has really big hands here. And why were they finding human body parts in the 60s as well? Because there was quite a few human bodies. And there was another case I found in Shropshire as well, where a skull was found. And the skull had holes in it, but the skull was determined not to have been killed in England. It was killed in another country. And there was no explanation about what the holes in the skull were for. And my first thought was maybe somebody had brought it over from Africa and it was a voodoo type. You know, they'd used it at home and then they thought, oh, I've had enough voodoo and I'm just going to discard, you know, so maybe it was that. But it was found in an area of this cave. And this was in Oswestry in Shropshire. And after finding these huge human hands, I found a lot of old cases that they talked about this cave being the entrance to the Knockers, and the Knockers lived underground there, and as well as the Fae. And the local people used to hear things coming from it, hear little whispering, but they couldn't work out what the words were. And it was said that even the foxes, when they were being chased by the horse and hounds, they would not go near the cave and they wouldn't go into it. They would rather run into the path of the hounds and be killed than go anywhere near that. And there's an old story where a piper had said, okay, well, I'm going to prove to you that this is a labyrinth down here, and I know that it will take me as far as the village church, so I'm going to go into it on Sunday, I'm going to take my instrument, and when you're in church I'm going to play it and you can all hear me. Well, he did do that. So he went down, went into the tunnels, found his way below the church, which was at least a couple of miles away, played his instrument and they could hear it, but he never came back out. He never came back out of the cave. I don't know. But the hands, I don't know why they would have them.
Yeah, just large hands.
Yeah. And in that chapter as well, which is not quite caves, but I was looking into tunnels as well, and there's a place called the Big Bull Tunnel in Virginia, and when they were building it, they had a lot of accidents down there, and after it was complete, a train was going through, a freight train, but just as it got into the tunnel, it broke down. So one of the engineers, John Perry, got out and he went to go to the other end of the tunnel to warn any other trains coming into it not to go in. But when he came back out of the tunnel, he was absolutely shaking and he was really white. And he told the other men, engineers that were with him, he said that he'd heard sounds that no man could stand. And the engineer and the conductor were so baffled by it, and they were not able to resist going back into the tunnel to find out what he was talking about. And they said that they could hear screams of agony and terror, and they heard groans of cries of pain. And the bravest of them said aloud, what's going on, to the voices. And they said, they swore that they heard a voice saying, remove this weight from my body. And then another voice that said, they're drinking my blood. Before and they tried to look in the walls and they couldn't see a gap, so it wasn't that there was a hole in the tunnel and it led somewhere where people were standing saying it. And this was in the newspapers at the time, back in the 1900s. And there was another tunnel in Massachusetts, the Hoosac Tunnel, where there's even rumours that there's this mysterious room that has been bricked up because the horrors inside of it are just so bad that nobody could bear to see it anymore. And a man had gone missing, a hunter had gone missing, Frank Webster. So they searched the tunnel because he'd been gone for 72 hours and they'd looked all around everywhere else, but they couldn't see him. Well, he emerged from the tunnel like 3 days later and he was in total shock. And he said that these dark apparitions had grabbed his gun and beat him with it. And then after that, he thinks he just must have passed out because he didn't remember anything about it. But there were also stories about how engineers down there, there was a big explosion once and two of the engineers were killed. And one of them, sorry, there was three of them down there, two were killed. But when they went in to try and rescue them, another one had been strangled. So, but they didn't have any argument going on between them. So, of course, the suggestion was something had strangled this man. I don't know.
And when you talk about like hearing voices and stuff out of caves, I mean, I would think that could be, that could be something where someone's consciousness is being messed with in some way, whether they're in an area that's altering their consciousness slightly and they're getting almost dreamlike imagery or something, or they're just tapping into another world entirely.
I just don't know. I don't know. I suppose you could say, you know, in terms of cage, I think it's CO2, isn't it? You could say that, you know, if you get a bit of oxygen deprivation, you could say, well, you're hallucinating. And if you go into tunnels and you work underground, it's enough to make anybody go a bit mad if you're in a confined space. But on the other hand, there may also be another explanation.
Well, sure. I just like kind of trying to throw some of these ideas around and work them and try to see if anything clicks, you know? Like I said, I'm convinced that consciousness plays a role in these things. It's just, I don't know exactly how. I forgot what I was just going to say about it. It just kind of blanked out on me.
It's because we're thinking. We're trying to think of what it could be.
And anything that involves fairy faith type stuff is always fascinating to me because, as we said earlier, it seems like there's something to it. It may not. I don't think it's exactly what it seems. I don't necessarily believe that there are literal fairies out there, but I think it's part of a phenomena that, I mean, as Jacques Vallée has shown, is likely connected with whatever the UFO phenomena is, and I don't think either of them are its true face. But it makes it so much more interesting, whereas before it could be like, oh yeah, all right, fairies. Now it's like, okay, now it's interesting because there might be some sense of reality behind it.
I'm stumped, Shariah. what I was looking into, I don't know which book it was for, but have you heard of High Brazil?
Yes.
The legend? Yeah. And so people wrote in old sailing accounts, you know, captains of the seas, how they would see this legendary island. And there were even stories of people being abducted to this island, and somehow when they got back off the island and got back onto the mainland, they had reports of all they could see were giant rabbits on the island, and the rabbits were holding them hostage.
Yeah, and that's just such a bizarre story, but it was consistent over numerous reports.
Yeah.
And I believe that the area where High Brazil was supposed to be, during the last ice age, the water level would have been low enough that would have actually been an island.
Oh.
So,
because they took it out of the maps, didn't they?
Yes, but it's on some of the older maps, so we know approximately where it was supposed to be. And it was Graham Hancock, I think, that pointted that out. He's like, you know, here's High Brazil, and during the last ice age, that would have been above water, so this is a map of an island that actually existed.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's good.
So, but
why did it have giant rabbits? Do you think they were just very healthy? Because they had all the food to themselves. They had all the grass to themselves.
Or maybe that's tied into something else. Maybe we remember, you know, as a people, we remember there was an island there, but then something else has happened and we tie it into that island.
Yeah, maybe.
Because the giant rabbits thing sounds like a hallucination or some kind of altered state, you know. You don't get a lot of giant rabbits running around holding people hostage.
I'd like to go there.
Although I'm sure if you look, you'll probably find some story of a giant rabbit attacking people. All right, so we've been talking about nightmares in the woods. And when did this one come out? This came out early 2016, right?
I believe so, yeah.
You don't even remember anymore.
I don't know. I've just got my head down. I'm always in my study, just in my head down. I'm like a mad professor, but without the brains.
What are you working on now?
Well, obviously the next one's Raya. I'm just putting things together for the next one. I did a couple of gothic books. I called them like gothic macabre because they were just really macabre stories which appealed to me. You know, like somebody keeping the skeleton of his wife for 20 years and, you know, he was dressing her up and dancing around doing waltzes and things in, you
really?
Know. Yeah. So things like that, you know. I don't know. And in fact, there was an island. I don't remember now where it was, but there's an island, and some Americans had gone there to explore it. And in fact, all they found of them were some hands. And it was said, that they'd been eaten by this cannibal group who actually were cannibals and did live on the island, but no other traces were found. And in fact, they'd been doing, when the rescuers got there, well, actually one of them was his brother, trying to find his now missing brother. When they got there, they found these pair of hands, but the hands didn't belong to them. They belonged to another group who'd been killed and eaten. And there was, in the sand, there was a mark where they'd done like a rain dance to sacrifice them.
Okay.
Yeah, now, I know.
Is this in a book you've already published?
Yeah, it's in, I think it's in Gothic Macabre.
Okay. Oh, that's the name of it.
Yeah. It's yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Stories of Gothic Macabre. It's not really sort of like these ones. It was just sort of, I was just taking a break to look into macabre stories, you know,
yeah,
as you do.
Unlike these.
Yeah. Unlike these ones, you know.
These are happy stories.
Yes, they are.
Okay. So next book will be out. Tomorrow? Next
I'm going for like a couple of months, Soraya.
All right. I don't believe you.
Or weeks. But... No, I know you don't. I know. Well, the thing is, it's my job. So, you know, I'm lucky to be doing something that's my passion. And to do it well, you have to do 16-hour days. And I don't mind that at all because I'm consider myself very fortunate and very lucky to be doing something that I love. But, you have to put the work in and the time in to do it. So, you know, but I'm very pleased with that. Very happy to be doing it. Very honored.
All right. Well, we thank you for doing it. And I thank you for talking with us tonight. Again, if people want the books, they can go find you on Amazon.
Yeah.
And people can contact you via email. What's the email?
It's StephenYoungAuthor@hotmail.com.
And again, let's explain to people that you initially wrote under the name Stephen because you were afraid people weren't going to take you seriously as a woman.
I was actually because I was writing a book about time travelers and I thought, well, you know, yes, they're not going to believe a woman. So I did write that. But also it's because I never actually expected to be on radio shows. I always thought I'd just be doing it more sort of for myself. I didn't, you know, so I never imagined that I'd be talking to you, Soraya. I just thought I'd be still in my study, you know, hiding behind my little desk. So, and of course, then when I come on radio shows, that's why I have to explain that I'm actually a woman. But I'm very happy for that.
And it's probably too much work to change it at this point, isn't it?
Well, I could just knock the two letters off at the end. I'm very lucky that I can just do that, knock off the E and the N, aren't I?
True.
Yeah, but it is kind of too late. But, I mean, that's the reason, because I didn't ever imagine that I would go onto radio shows, you know?
And it's not unusual for people to write under a pen name. I mean, that's a fairly common thing. It's just not super common in this field.
Yeah, well, actually, Voltaire wrote under a pen name as well. So not that I'm comparing myself to somebody with those kind of brains, but yeah, it's a very, you know, it's a very common thing in literature and in philosophy and all sorts of things. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, again, thank you for spending some time with us, Steph, and we will have you back soon because we still got two more books that you already published to talk about.
Yeah, I would love that. Thank you so much, Soraya.
All right. All right. That concludes my talk with Steph Young. If you have any stories you want to submit to us for our listener story show, go to the website. I believe the email is stories@wheretodtheroadgo.com, but you can find everything under the contact tab at wheretodtheroadgo.com. And if you have any music you'd like us to use at the end of the show, if it's your music and you'd like us to use it, or at least consider using it, drop us a line. Again, go to the contact tab, drop us a line, and we'll check it out. If I think it'll work, I will totally put it on the end of a show at some point with info on how to contact you. So, all right. Tonight, we're going to end with Nightmares from Psyche Corporation just because it's so damn appropriate. See you next week.
Shut the closet door. It's under the floor. The monster's there. Among these ghosts.
Shut the clock.